Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hillary Clinton headed out today for her sixth trip to the Asia-Pacific as Secretary of State. President Obama is headed to India next week. My guest today, global scholar and traveler Robert Kaplan, says it's high time to wake up to what he calls Monsoon Asia, a new nexus of power and conflict around the Indian Ocean that will come to dominate, he says, this century. This hour on Point, Robert Kaplan on Monsoon Asia rising and America's challenge there. You can join the conversation. Do you hear the drumbeat of stories of minerals, pipelines, high-tech conflict out of Monsoon Asia? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first for a preview of the president's looming India trip is Ed Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He was previously posted in India, New Delhi, as the South Asia Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He's author of In Spite of the Gods, The Rise of Modern India. Ed Luce, thanks for joining us.
Many thanks for having me, Tom.
Everybody in the States is focused on the midterm elections, but within days of those, President Obama will be in India. Why? Why India and why now, Ed?
Well, he's long promised Manmohan Singh, India's Prime Minister, that he would pay a presidential visit to India. And in fact, he hosted his first state visit as president. He hosted Manmohan Singh. So he's long set a very sort of high priority on taking U.S.-India relations forward. And I think if you recall this time last year, the president's visit to China, which I was on, there was a slight gaffe when Hu Jintao and President Obama read out their joint communique in the Great Hall of the People. There was a sentence in there that I don't think the Americans were fully aware of the import, that said the two countries, China and the United States, would work together to promote peace and stability in the broader South Asian region beyond AFPAC. Which
not the Far East, not Northeast Asia, but South Asia, India country.
Indeed, and to Indian ears, that immediately rang the alarm bell, Kashmir, which they believe and state as an internal matter, susceptible to no third-party mediation. And that caused a huge... it caused a storm in a teacup in New Delhi.
Why such a high priority now on India? Why this visit now? And what do you know of the agenda when the president's there, Ed?
The agenda is slightly problematic because the previous administration, the Bush administration, had pushed through this enormous, unprecedented deal on India's behalf, the civil nuclear deal, that although India is a non-signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it gave it pretty much all the benefits of as if it were a member. There's nothing the Obama administration can do to emulate that. But to complicate matters, the Indian Parliament recently passed a law, the Civil Nuclear Liability Law, that makes it virtually impossible for a potential American suppliers like GE and Westinghouse to get involved in the growing Indian civil nuclear industry. It makes them liable for any accident for as long as 80 years. And that law has really sort of brought to a halt this centerpiece of the new U.S.-India relationship, strategic partnership. And there's very little right now the Indians can do to get around it. So that's going to be the big fly in the ointment.
A big issue there. Then there's the Afghan war. Obama, by all accounts, wants out of Afghanistan as soon as he can manage it. How does that figure into the visit?
That's going to be a huge part of the conversation. The Indians would like the Americans to stay a lot longer. They see a vacuum emerging with the departing Americans that Pakistan would fill, or they fear Pakistan would fill. They want to see Obama backing President Karzai of Afghanistan far more robustly than Washington has been, and that's going to be something unlikely. That President Obama is going to be unlikely to be able to oblige on, given all the allegations of corruption. in Kabul. So there's a lot of differences in the Indian and U.S. vision of Afghanistan. And the Indians would like to fight the Taliban down to the last American.
Yeah, no, perhaps. Finally, Ed, what about China? Is this visit, is it a visit, been pretty testy between the U.S. and China recently on trade and currency and more? Is this a visit against China?
Well, China will be the huge sort of publicly undeclared topic of this visit. As your next guest has written about eloquently, the Indian-Chinese jostling in the Indian Ocean and around the Arabian Sea, the maritime great game, if you like, between these two countries, is an enormous new geopolitical fact of the last few years, and it's been particularly visible and tense in the last 18 months or so. How the two countries will manage and handle the rise of China is, I think, the first item on India's priority list. It's unclear what Obama can do publicly to take this issue forward, but it's clearly in private going to be the number one item of discussion.
President Obama off to India and more in Asia next week. Ed Luce is Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, former South Asia Bureau Chief in New Delhi. Ed, thanks very much for being with us.
Many thanks for having me.
Joining me now from Los Angeles is Robert Kaplan. He's Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, National Correspondent for The Atlantic, and a member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. He's author of a dozen books on foreign policy, geopolitics, and religion. His latest is Monsoon, the Indian Ocean, and the Future of American Power. Robert Kaplan, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
The president's off to India next week. That's right in the heart of Monsoon Asia. Does that mean America's on top of the dynamics you're describing in your book, Robert?
I think the Obama administration is more and more, because the president is not just going to India. Mm-hmm. He's going to Indonesia, South Korea, and Japan, and maybe Australia.
Big
we'll
trip.
See when the final itinerary comes out. And more importantly, Secretary of State Clinton is going to be in the region in Vietnam, Malaysia, Australia. And what they're confronting is this increasingly strategic rimland of navigable southern Eurasia from the Horn of Africa all the way through the Strait of Malacca and the Indonesian archipelago up to the Sea of Japan. The president will not be running away from domestic problems, as will be alleged. He is confronting the world, the new strategic reality in a post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan world. And we can talk individually about the countries he's visiting, but what unites all of them is facing the challenge of a rising China, whether it's India, Indonesia, or wherever.
A rising China, another challenge, though, that you point to right at the beginning of your book, Monsoon. You want us to kind of turn the globe. You say the map of Europe and its sort of position on the planet defined 20th century, from Flanders Field to Omaha Beach to the Berlin Wall. It was very Eurocentric and maybe for Americans, Atlantic and Pacific-centric. And you're saying sort of turn the globe. Look at this great southern ocean, the Indian Ocean, what you call the rimland along it. Why? What's happening there?
Well, first of all, Americans have been prisoners, Tom, of the Mercator projection, which is the map most of us see when we go to grade school. It's got the North America, South America smack in the center, and the Indian and Pacific Oceans are kind of confined and divided up at the edges. But what's happening in the Indian Ocean is several things. First of all, it's emerging as the world's global energy interstate, where all the hydrocarbons, the oil and natural gas from the Arabian Peninsula, the Iranian Plateau, is being boarded onto massive ships, tankers, and sailed across the Indian Ocean through the Strait of Malacca up to the burgeoning middle-class flesh pots of Asia. So this is where all the energy traffic is. And in this jet and information age where we live, nevertheless, 90% of all goods travel by sea. And the bulk of commercial goods go from the Middle East to East Asia across the Indian Ocean. And also, the Indian Ocean is where we can more clearly see the increasing rivalry between India and China, which will define Eurasian politics in the 21st century. Mm. And a third thing that's very important is that we Americans tend to see Islam as a desert-centric religion supposedly prone to the extremities of thought to which deserts give rise. But by concentrating on the Indian Ocean, we can see the whole other side of Islam, which is as a cosmopolitan maritime religion, where Islam was spread by sophisticated traders across the longitudes from Arabia to the South Seas. Sinbad the Sailor, was an Omani who sailed from Basra in today's Iraq. Mm-hmm. And when you read the accounts of his voyages, they sound very similar to Borneo, to Malaysia, to the Philippines, because Sinbad the Sailor, the story, is very indicative of where these medieval Arabs and Persians sailed to.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what may be the emerging as the world's new center of gravity, Asia, from the Horn of Africa to the belly of China. My guest today, Robert Kaplan, calls it Monsoon Asia. His new book is Monsoon, the Indian Ocean, and the Future of American Power. President Obama headed to India and more next week. South Korea, Indonesia, maybe Australia, Japan, and Hillary Clinton there already. Defense Secretary, the Pentagon briefing today on the president's upcoming trip to India. Robert Kaplan joins us from Los Angeles. And Robert, let me put this right to you. Here's a web comment. We've got lots, but here's one right away from Shiva, who says, "To me, Monsoon Asia is a fairy tale. Look at the chaos in South Asia, the pivot of the Indian Ocean. The whole region is slowly moving toward political failure, corruption, discord among ethnic groups, arrogance of the political class, widening inequality. In my view," writes Shiva, "South Asia has failed to build upon its burgeoning economic growth." What do you say, Bob Kaplan?
Well, I sympathize because, in fact, I write a lot about the problems he's detailing in his comment. But to kind of reduce this a bit to geopolitics, India's economic growth rate, even during this age of the Great Recession, has been very robust. And India is surrounded, however, by semi-failed states, not just Pakistan, but Nepal, Bangladesh, and off the Palk Straits in the southeast, Sri Lanka. All these, and let us not forget Burma to the east. Mm-hmm. So what's preventing India from becoming a great power vis-a-vis China is precisely the problems that this person is alluding to. It's that India's, let me put it this way, Tom, I had a long meeting with the chief of the Indian Army and a long meeting with the chief of the Indian Navy. When you meet with the chief of the Indian Navy, it's all good news. He's got warships in the Mozambique Channel in Southeast Africa. He's got warships in the South China Sea. India's rising as a Monroe Doctrine-style great power.
Is that good news? Is that good? Or you're saying he sees it as good news?
He sees it as mm-hmm. good news. Mm-hmm. When you talk to the chief of the Indian Army, he's tearing his hair out. He's got a Naxalite, Maoist trending insurgency in East Central India. He's dealing not only with the propensity of infiltration, terrorist infiltration from Pakistan, but millions of refugees from Bangladesh into West Bengal, or the propensity of millions of refugees coming from the southern part of Nepal into northern India. He's got all these problems at its borders, and it's precisely these problems which are occupying and preoccupying the attention of Indian policymakers that is preventing India from taking the grand leap of its imagination
becoming a global power. But I think, maybe Shiva's looking even a little wider. I mean, India, never mind. Look at Pakistan next door.
Yeah.
Count in Afghanistan, if you like. Iran on this watery expanse you describe, or go the other way. You mentioned Bangladesh, but look at Burma. It's got elections coming up, complete sham, everybody's
right.
saying, but they're looking, you know, to sort of get some kind of global acceptance there. I mean, more broadly, you're presenting it as an emerging powerhouse. I can see it from that angle, but Shiva turns it, you know, another way and says, woo, these are overwhelming-looking problems.
I don't think Shiva's going to have any problems with my chapter on Burma, because the chapter on Burma is quite depressing indeed. It's not just the fact that we have one of the world's most benighted military regimes in power. It's that even democracy like Iraq, like Yugoslavia, would not solve Burma's problem, because over a third of the population are ethnics with their own armies that contest ethnic Burman rule of the country. So even were this military regime to collapse, there would be no infrastructure, no institutions, and a lot of ethnic rivalries to solve. This is kind of the wasteland that 48 years of military rule has left Burma. Let's turn to Pakistan.
Well,
could we
stay there just for one moment? Right? Because
sure.
it may be a wasteland in a way. We're going to see results from these elections. Some people may come out and say it's better now. There's even talk that Aung San Suu Kyi may be released soon after these elections in that attempt. Do you see, and China, is clearly looking at resources there, maybe looking at access to the very waters you're talking about.
Yes.
Are we going to see China, I don't know about India, sort of papering over the political problems in Burma for the resources, for the transit?
Not only China will paper over the problems, but India will as well. Burma is rich in natural gas, in uranium, in timberland, in enormous stores of hydropower. India cannot stand idly by and watch China make Burma a veritable satellite. China is busy building roads and pipelines, wanting to connect the natural gas off the Bay of Bengal on Burma's coast with links directly into southern China, so that China can avoid having to bring all of its oil and natural gas through the congested Strait of Malacca. India can't stand by and watch this happen, so that while even though India is a democratic power, India has a very strong relations with the Burmese military. It's trading heavily with Burma. Indian policymakers tell me, you Americans from half a world away can moralize about Burma, but if Burma being right next door, where there are a number of ethnic insurgents that are pouring over to India, we can't. We have no choice but to deal with the regime.
And to stay in that neck of the woods for just a moment, you're talking about something that I had not caught any wind of. That is China considering a Panama Canal-style canal across the isthmus of southern Thailand there. I had no idea.
Yes. Yes. Not just China, Japan, South Korea all have a stake in this. First of all, a canal across the Isthmus of Kra in Thailand would cost about $20 billion and would be an engineering feat equivalent to the Panama Canal. And it's not just a canal. Dubai Ports World is doing a feasibility study on a land bridge across the Malaysian Peninsula. The Malaysian government itself is considering another canal or railroad connecting.
What's pushing all this?
What's pushing all this is that there's going to be a 45% increase in oil and natural gas consumption, and half of that is going to come from East Asia. And there's just too much there's just too many ships coming through the narrow shoal, pirate-infested Strait of Malacca. Mm-hmm. And so these big Asian powerhouses are looking for alternatives. And so they're not just looking at canals and land bridges to connect the Bay of Bengal with the South China Sea. China wants to build a port. It is building a port in Gwadar in Pakistan. It's building pipelines and roads throughout Central Asia. It's trying every way it can to get oil, natural gas, strategic metals, and strategic minerals into China without having to go through the Strait of Malacca.
We'll look at that. And I know we've still got Pakistan hanging there, but we've got callers for you. Let's get to Harry on. Harry in Boston, you're on the air with Robert Kaplan.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Kaplan, I just came back from an island. I'm from Mauritius. I got to tell you what you're saying. I just witnessed that with
Mauritius,
eyes.
Right in the middle of the Indian Ocean, islands right there.
Oh, my God. Yep.
What's going on? What's happening?
It's unbelievable. The airport is futuristic. So far, much better than what we have in Boston. The road, the telecommunication system. The Chinese just finished the construction of a trans-continent logistics center on the island. It's unbelievable. And in the end, they have a major center for IT over there. They have imported like 200,000 people, foreigners, to work. And the unemployment is like 2%. And the system, the entire island is under construction. It's like a major shopping, medical center, telecommunications. Anything you can mention, it's just unbelievable.
So you're seeing it, Harry. Talk about monsoon Asia and Indian Ocean. You're looking at the Mauritius right in the middle of it, and it sounds pretty hot.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. Bob.
Yes. Let me just add this. In Mauritius, Reunion, the Comoros, all these islands of the western half of the Indian Ocean, more or less south of the Arabian Sea, the Indian and Chinese are in very strong competition. The Indians more or less have tremendous influence over the coast guards of these islands, into the intelligence services in these islands. It's sort of like a proxy great game that India and China are competing with each other in these islands, also in Sri Lanka, in Burma, as we've just talked about, mm-hmm. in Bangladesh. And so it's really, I wouldn't call this a conflict. I would call it an increasingly strong rivalry.
You write about not so far from Mauritius on this grand scale. Speaking of Pakistan, the Pakistani port, Gwadar, and what's gone on there historically and what's going on there now, to give us a kind of a clue to where the region may be headed.
Yes, Gwadar is in southwest Pakistan, in the region called Balochistan, right on the Arabian Sea part of the Indian Ocean, close to the entrance to the Straits of Hormuz. Gwadar is a very picturesque, quiet fishing village. It reminded me of the lithographs of David Roberts of mm-hmm. Palestine and Lebanon that he did in the 19th century. And yet, the Chinese have just completed the building of a spanking new port, and there are plans for all kinds of maritime warehouse facilities, luxury hotels. What's going on here? The Chinese hope at some point to connect Gwadar all the way up through Pakistan by roads and pipelines into western China.
This Karakoram Highway they're working on.
Right, which the Chinese also built. Exactly, Tom. And what I found in Gwadar was we've still got a long way to go. This new spanking port is not destiny yet. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because Pakistan itself is in such a state of disarray. There is very little security in the area. Ethnic Baloch told me, threatened to me that they would kill Chinese workers there if the Chinese started to build a road or a pipeline, because the ethnic Baloch want autonomy from Pakistan itself. They're fighting a war with the Pakistanis themselves, and they feel a lot of this land for the port and adjacent structures is being stolen from the ethnic Baloch residents of the area and given to wealthy Pakistani money men to make money on the tremendous rise in real estate in Gwadar. So will Gwadar grow up to be more than a beautiful 19th century style fishing port and become, say, the next Dubai or Abu Dhabi? It depends what happens with Pakistan itself.
So you've got some chaos in Pakistan, but set against that, these enormous appetites for resources from China and appetites for access from China. There's the contest. Larry in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Robert Kaplan.
Yes, thanks. I'm a retired history teacher from Cambridge Virginia Latin High School, and the point I want to make that I've always made to my students is that the Indian Ocean has a long history, which was always neglected in our history books. And there was a time when the Indian Ocean, when it was the Islamic trading system after the fall of the Roman Empire, and the Mediterranean sort of fell away from a hub of traffic and trade. The Indian Ocean, under the Islamic trading system, was very international and huge in wealth, with all these resources from all these outlying areas, China, Indonesia, East Africa, the Middle East, as we call it today, all trading with one another out of Baghdad and Damascus, where all these operations were headed. Osama bin Laden talks about this golden age that he would love to return to, because it was a golden age of astronomy and science and medicine and literature and art, and it really was, because Europe was in the dark ages and had fallen to feudalism, and they were thriving in a great high civilization.
Yeah.
I think people, we're seeing this all happening again. We're seeing this all happening again. And, of course, there was a religious aspect to all this, because what was happening was the Crusades trying to get back at Islam and failing to get back at Islam and finally being shut out when Constantinople fell and became Istanbul. And it was the first the Spanish, then the Portuguese, that finally broke out of Europe and again around Africa into the Indian Ocean.
Right. Larry, you put so much on the table. I want to get Robert Kaplan in on it. A golden age emerging here not
this
stuff?
I feel that Larry is like my brother, because I write all about this in the early chapters of the book. He's really got it. First of all, in fact, he's right that before the Portuguese came in the end of the 15th century, which began 500 years of Western rule, this was a very coherent international trading system, so much so that you had Arabs and Persians in the east coast of China. You had Chinese and Malaysian and Indonesian merchants in East Africa. What caused all this? It's the fact that the Indian Ocean is the only ocean in the world that has the monsoon winds. And the monsoon winds are reversible winds. They flow in one direction for 6 months, and then they reverse by 180 degrees in the other direction. That made sailing distances predictable, so that sailors knew exactly when they were going to arrive, and that meant that the Indian Ocean, unlike the Atlantic and Pacific, did not have to wait for the age of steamships to unite it. And it's why you have Yemeni communities in Indonesia. It's why you have Malay communities in Madagascar. This has been a small, intimate ocean in a cultural sense going back to antiquity. When Vasco da Gama sailed to Western India from what is today Kenya, he did not discover India. He rediscovered the secrets of the monsoon winds that were given to him by Arab navigators.
And Osama bin Laden's dream of all this brought back to prominence, does that matter here?
I don't really think it matters, because in this, one of the things that I'm predicting in my book is that we're going to go back to an international global trading system from the Horn of Africa to the Sea of Japan that was very much like the peaceful Arab-Persian trading system before Vasco da Gama's voyage. And in this new trading system that is in fact emerging, the Chinese are going to be the first among equals. So the real clash of civilizations, if you will not be between the West and the East. It'll be between the Chinese vision of consumer capitalism and this politicized Islam that's being spread by Wahhabi preachers all over the region from Saudi Arabia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what may be emerging as the world's new center of gravity, Asia. From the Horn of Africa to the belly of China, the Sea of Japan, my guest today, Robert Kaplan, calls it Monsoon Asia. His new book is Monsoon, the Indian Ocean, and the Future of American Power. Joins us from Los Angeles. Let's go straight to Sheetal, calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Sheetal, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Sheetal here.
Hi.
I just wanted to bring up one comparative study that's usually made between India and China. Like, India is considered to be a sleeping elephant and China as a dragon. And the sleeping elephant, when it gets up, I mean, and once it's turned up their momentum, it can have the same impact as the other animal. That's usually been said in the Chinese segment. And one of the things that they usually talk about India is its diversity, which can be a strength and weakness. And the diversity as a whole, India is considered to be a multi-region, religion, multicultural place with most of the languages spoken. So it resembles a small world by itself, and how most of the people work it out among them to come up with a democratic approach. And usually the Chinese segment tries to have the cons, like the diversity, to be much, much more diverse in such a way that it never grows. And India usually, due to the democracy, has the advantage of bringing in the synergy among the diversity, which you can see now with the signals showing that India can be the next next important player in the world.
Chitel, we've got it, and it's a lot. I appreciate it. Robert Kaplan, how about it? Fast dragon China, you know, slower elephant India, but watch out once it gets its momentum. I don't know. Where do you go with that? And then there's the diversity piece.
Because India is a democracy, it's inherently more stable than China's authoritarian capitalist system. But even though it's more stable, India is, the Indian government is not a conducive way to get things done in India. Let me give you a statistic. China adds more paved highways per year than India has in total. In China, the government gets things done. In India, things get done in spite of the government, not because of it, because institutions are weaker than they are in China. India is going to overtake China as the world's most populous country in 2032. China, we know, is emerging as a great global power. India is still at the stage of being a great regional power. Whether it will be a global power on the same level of China is something we'll have to wait and see.
Okay, let's look. I want to go to – there's a lot to talk about, but I want to look at Afghanistan with all these players. You write at one point, you say the Indian Ocean may be the essential place to contemplate the future of U.S. power.
Yes.
Let's just talk about the future of this war that the United States is so deeply invested in for so many years now.
Yeah.
There was a big Foreign Policy magazine article recently looking at all the – minerals and resources in Afghanistan that might flow through Afghanistan.
$1 trillion. Yeah,
and the headline was, looking at Afghanistan, the headline was Chinese takeout. All this fighting going on, but it ultimately is about pipelines and resources that are likely to flow to China. How does all this figure into what's likely to be the course of the conflict there, its settlement, what happens on the other side?
Right. We Americans, President Obama especially, is asking himself, how can we leave Afghanistan? The Chinese are asking themselves, how can we stay in Afghanistan? China is already prospecting for copper in Afghanistan with Chinese workers protected by U.S. troops. There's $1 trillion worth of minerals, strategic metals, lithium, others, other natural resources under the Afghanistan earth. If the United States were to succeed in, let's say, semi-stabilizing Afghanistan and semi-stabilizing Pakistan, that would just open up great strategic opportunities with China. We would leave and China would be the victor. Because if you look at a map of the Tang Dynasty of 8th century China, you see a Chinese trading net worth extending all the way west and southwest into the northeastern Iran and the region of Khorasan. So this is not new territory for China. What China envisions is a road and pipeline network that would swing west into Central Asia and Afghanistan and then south to Gwadar and Pakistan.
The big
and
port.
Right. And India, too, so China has an interest in us succeeding in Afghanistan, but I don't think it wants us to succeed too fast because it also has an interest in us being distracted in Afghanistan so that we don't do enough to deal with the rise of the Chinese Navy in the Western Pacific. India, too, has an interest in the U.S. Succeeding in Afghanistan, as Ed Liu said at the top of the hour earlier in the show. For the Indians, Afghanistan is not some remote country in Central Asia. It's inherently part of the subcontinent. One empire after another from antiquity into the Middle Ages encompassed eastern Afghanistan, all of Pakistan, and all of northern India as part of the same polity.
But, you know, let me ask you if I may. Back early in the Afghan War, there used to be plenty of people who said, they say it's about bin Laden, but this is really about pipeline access across Afghanistan. But the presumption surely there was that it was an American pipeline, but you're talking a Chinese pipeline.
Absolutely, yes.
Was there ever any truth to that?
I don't believe so, because in fact we're getting more and more of our oil from South America and the Gulf of Guinea, and less from the region that I'm writing about. This is mainly for India and China.
You write in Monsoon, you say the sum total effect of U.S. preoccupation with Iraq and Afghanistan has been to fast forward the arrival of the Asian century, not only in economic terms that we all know about, but in military terms as well.
Yes, that's true. While we've been preoccupied with messy, dirty land wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Chinese, the Indian navies have been growing by leaps and bounds, and the navies of Japan and South Korea have been modernizing apace, and the defense budgets of Southeast Asian countries over the last 10 years have grown by about 30%. Within the next 10 or 15 years, there probably will be more Chinese submarines than there are American submarines. This doesn't mean that the Chinese Navy is going to overtake the U.S. Navy. The quality of our equipment and naval platforms is far superior. But it does mean that the gap is being closed, that the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific will no longer be American lakes, so to speak, like they were since the end of World War II through the Cold War and into the first years of the post-Cold War. We're entering a multipolar military system. India is going to be the world's third largest navy in a few years. Japan already has four times as many warships as the British Royal Navy.
Well, we've got a lot to look at here. Robert Kaplan is with us. His new book is Monsoon. Let's go to Georgia. Ron, in Augusta, Georgia, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit about why China and India have become such world pluggers with all this construction going on and expansion. And yet, the United States, we seem to be getting smaller in our, you know, our world vision or something. And is it regulation? Is it simply population? I mean, they import a lot of their raw materials and et cetera, things like that. And I just wondered if you could discuss that maybe a little bit, and I'll listen off the air.
It all happens fast. I'm sure a lot of people are still scratching their head on the same thing. Bob Kaplan, last night on the news, we see a new high-speed rail system in China.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, 150 miles at 200 and some world record-breaking. They're going to double it again in the next couple of years, and we're still, you know, just kind of fooling around. Why? The big why question from Ron.
These countries have incredible dynamism and a tremendous degree of old meat and potatoes 1950s style nationalism. The elites of India and China may argue about a lot of things, but they're united in a way that our elites used to be divided, in the early Cold War eras. You don't find the rank partisanship like you do in the United States. There's a sense of national purpose. If you look at the United States from the end of the Civil War to the outbreak of World War I, the U.S. economy grew by leaps and bounds almost every year. And as a result, we developed trading relationships with countries all over the world in the late 19th century. And as a result of that, suddenly we built a great Navy and a great Marine Corps and a great Army to protect those relationships abroad. China and India are going through a similar process that the United States went through from the late 1860s to 1914.
Is this a kind of inevitability? Let's say that American elites were not divided. If they were on one page and they were, you know, vigorously sort of working out best strategies here and implementing them, would we be out front of India and China in dynamism? Or is there simply something structural like their turn of the pendulum?
Nothing is inevitable, obviously. It's not inevitable that Gwadar will be a great port. It's not inevitable that the United States will go into decline. And also, keep in mind that decline is an overrated word. Mm-hmm. The British Royal Navy actually began its decline in 1895, but Britain went on to help save the West in World War I and World War II, right up through the Suez Crisis of 1956. So the United States
the United States.
Yeah, yes. But nevertheless, my point is that the United States may be in relative decline, but that doesn't mean that some of its most critical, pivotal decades are not ahead of it.
Larry in Morgantown, Kentucky. Larry, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. You've covered just about everything that I was going to say with those last few comments there. But I've been looking at the economic situations the United States has, and a great deal of it has come from, in my opinion, the fact that China and India and whatever third world country coming on up after them, after they make their rise, whatever they come to. But the thing is, I've had many people say to me, wonder why we can't have the jobs, wonder why we can't do, you know, have the work going on. Well, the thing is, I keep telling them, until China catches us, until India catches us, until Mexico catches us. And what I'm talking about is not just the production. I'm talking about the money that we're spending on the individual. And how can I say this without hurting anybody's feelings?
What, consumption, consumerism in the United States? What?
Yeah, welfare is what I'm talking about. And I've got nothing against welfare for people that need it, but those that don't need it, I'm just not really, excited about.
Larry, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Robert Kaplan, let's go to this issue. First of all, Larry's suggesting maybe we have to wait until China and India catch us, till their wages are the same, the standard of living is the same as the United States, and then all compete on a level playing field. And welfare is the difference?
That's not how nations work. Nations strive. Each nation is seeking to adjust the balance of power, the balance of trade in its own favor. And because they make mistakes and they overcompensate for these adjustments, that's how wars, trade wars, and military wars come about. Actually, the world I'm describing presents a great opportunity for the United States, because in a world of competing great Asian powers, competing both militarily and economically, the United States remains the indispensable power around the rimland of Eurasia. The only power with a great naval and air presence that has no territorial pretensions in Asia itself. India needs the United States to help it balance against China. Indonesia, which we haven't spoken about, desperately needs the presence of the United States Navy because China is emerging as Indonesia's biggest trading partner, and the Indonesians are afraid of being engulfed by China. The same with South Korea and Japan. And meanwhile, the United States and China need each other because of very complex financial issues.
Well, let me ask you then. Because we can only support that military, that U.S. naval presence with a strong economic base beneath it. How would the United States? There's the economy, and then there's the strategic positioning. We've been in Iraq, we're in Afghanistan. How would the U.S. optimize
its position?
You've
hit the most important question, Tom. The U.S. Navy used to be about 580 ships during the Reagan era. It was 350 during the Clinton era. It's down to 286. According to the Congressional Budget Office and others, we may be looking at a 250 warship Navy in coming decades. And I think even that's still big enough to acquit ourselves of our responsibilities in the world that, in the geographical region that I'm talking about. But the bottom line is that because naval and air platforms are so expensive, with ships costing $1 billion apiece and fighter jets up to $100 million apiece, the size of your Navy and Air Force is ultimately determined by the health of your economy. And if our economy remains wobbly for another decade or so, while China's grows by 5-10% a year, or upwards, the distance between our naval and air strength and their naval and air strength is going to start to close.
Talk to us about the big tactical picture then, and maybe this is strategic, I don't know, but Afghanistan. It's hard for me to figure out from your comments whether you think the U.S. should be there fighting so that China can one day mine its copper and everything else, or get out or something else.
We should try. Actually, I'm completely in sync with President Obama on this. Get out as soon as possible, but you can't get out precipitously. It's got to be conditions-based, because once you've been in a place so long, you build up equities. If we were to withdraw precipitously from Afghanistan, just pull all of our troops out. You could have the appearance of bin Laden and Zawahiri before Al Jazeera in Jalalabad. You could have, you know, the collapse of the Afghan government, the weakening of Pakistan. Nevertheless, we're spending $1 trillion a year there. I think it's $1 trillion over 10 years, $100 billion a year, excuse me. Mm-hmm. $100 billion a year buys you two or three aircraft carrier strike groups that could be patrolling in East Asia.
So it's a question of where all the countries should put their resources.
Yeah, how do we reduce our troop strength from 100,000 to 50 or 40,000 as soon as possible?
Well, Robert Kaplan, you may have me persuaded. We need to go around to those classrooms and adjust that Mercator projection, get that Indian Ocean up a little higher on the minds of Americans young and old. The new book is Monsoon, the Indian Ocean, and the Future of American Power. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Kaplan in Los Angeles, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.